Welcome to Dreaming in Color, a space for social change leaders of color to reflect on how their unique life experiences, personal and professional, have prepared them to lead and drive the impact we all seek. I'm your host, Darren Isom. This season, we're traveling to the continent to highlight African leaders and the continent's role as a key driver of global innovation and leadership. So join us as we travel across the continent, from South Africa to Tunisia, with stops in Kenya, Ethiopia, Nigeria, and Senegal along the way, celebrating the diaspora and all of its complexity and beautiful possibility. This is Dreaming in Color, Africa. Today I'm in Benin City, Nigeria, talking with Ore Disu. Ore has led the Museum of West African Art, MOA, as the founding director of this institute since January 2022. MOA seeks to revisit how cultural values define, focusing on pre-colonial African perspectives, geographical boundaries and practices of care, and creativity before Eurocentric values shape these definitions. Prior to this, she was the founding executive director of Nisibidi Institute, a nonprofit cultural think tank in Lagos, Nigeria, and a development practitioner. She has over a decade of experience in cultural programming, research, and stakeholder engagement for early stage organizations. She's a strong advocate for people-centered design, expansion of new publics, and talent development on the continent. Ore, welcome to Dreaming in Color. It's great to chat with you today. Thanks for making time and space. As you know, I hand you the stage to start off the conversation with invocation. What do you have for us?
I have to search deep for this one, Darren. I will start with a bit of a confession, actually, if you don't mind. I do not speak Yoruba fluently. This is my father's tongue, and to a large extent, it's indicative of a certain perception for middle-class Nigerians in a very new independent state, whereby having to learn your own tongue was considered to be potentially endangering your ability to speak English well. But nevertheless, I have dug deep, and I came up with, I think, a saying that says a lot about my journey. So here it goes. Kiso, kugbadwe isu. This literally translates to the river, no matter how far it flows, always knows its source. And I think it's a really powerful way to both talk about how history and our connection to whether land or community of origin really powerfully projects us into the future. And if we can hold on to that, there's always an element of, I think, groundedness that takes us into our future spaces. And it's been one of the reasons why I've always wanted to work in the culture and creative industry. It's one of the reasons why policy has also been a really important part of the work that I've been doing over the last 15 odd years in Nigeria. But it also, I think, talks about humble beginnings. And that's not always something that people, especially as we scale and go into spaces of more ambitious platforms, it's not always something that we can hold on to unless we remind ourselves of.
And that's a beautiful way to start the conversation. So many analogies there with the power of rivers and streams, and we're all the product of small streams that became great rivers to some degree. I want to start going a little upstream then. I know that you grew up in Lagos.
Yes.
A city that I have not visited, but I've heard wonderful things about. I would love for you just to share a little bit more about your early influences and experiences in Lagos and beyond that helped shape your understanding of cultural heritage and the role of arts in society.
Absolutely. I will try not to be offended that you haven't visited Lagos.
I know. Listen, the eye rolls are strong every time I know.
But so Lagos for me is home. It's where both my parents were born. And to a large extent, it's, I think, a macrocosm of Nigeria and all of the cross-cultural influences that have traversed that space and shaped into what it is today. I grew up in a really, I think, unique and idyllic neighborhood called Ikeja, which actually was wise. But having them just within proximity of my family home meant that I was always able to relate to people who didn't really look or sound like me. So these were people who came from quite diverse backgrounds. But once you, as kids, you're in a space together, all of those trappings of social hierarchy don't tend to be come to the fore as much. And I think that's in some ways what museums can do. They create spaces where you can connect to people who don't immediately have an obvious association or commonality with you. And I think that's been an important element of what I've tried to carry into every space that I've gone into in my career, including, while I was studying architecture, to working in public sector to now working in this really amazing institution that is really trying to do something different with culture.
Mm. And I love this idea of, in some ways, modeling that museum world or curated space as a child and normalizing that into adulthood. So much of your work is about reclaiming and preserving African knowledge systems. Do you see yourself as continuing a lineage of thinkers, artists, or cultural stewards in your own family or community? Are you the family or community griot?
I'd like to think so. Thank you very much. I'm definitely the child who spent countless hours poring through family albums, bothering my great uncles and aunts to tell me stories, got really close to my grandmother as a result of that, but also learned a lot more about my own family history and how it connects to the founding, so to speak, of Lagos Island, which some of our readers or listeners might know was actually a former British colony, quite separate from the southern and northern protectorate states in Nigeria of the time. But it's through these relationships that I was able to understand better a history that stems from my family, but also connects to the history of the city, the history of Nigeria, and our connection globally. In many ways, I think what I'm doing within MOA Institute is providing that institutional backing and support to bring in other sources of knowledge and ground it both in memory, but also in evidenced history. Right now, we are sitting in one of my favorite interim rooms. It's the pottery specialist room. And as you can see, there are countless of terracotta shards that have been dug up from across this site. I think sometimes when you think about research and about storytelling, we don't really connect to the materiality of it. It's a space that I think with the establishment of our material science lab, with collections facilities, just by providing that space and the infrastructure and technologies to assess and interpret these materials, we can start to unravel more knowledge and get people to connect to history in a much more concrete way.
And this reminds me of this beautiful Ted Chiang quote. Ted Chiang is a fiction writer back in the States, Chinese American. And he has this beautiful quote that I'm completely going to mess up, I'm sure. But of course, quotes where you take inspiration from them. He talks about how this understanding of history as being a collection of facts is a very Western concept. Griots and bards around the world have always understood that the point of history was to remind a community of who they were. And as a result, sometimes the stories needed to change. And so hearing you talk about this idea of how you collect these various pieces and the stories you tell moving forward based on that is really powerful and meaningful. And I hope that resonates for you.
For sure. I think there's always this tension between objectivity and storytelling, as you mentioned.
Very powerful. Now, I want to jump in with your vision for MOA, a center to propel scholarship and the exchange of knowledge on the continent. Feels like a contemporary echo of Timbuktu, which once drew and influenced scholars and thinkers from across Africa and beyond. What lessons do you take from the past when thinking about how knowledge can be preserved, generated, and shared today?
That's a really powerful and invocative, if I may say, question. Benin has its own, I think, historic resonance. And I think that's been a really important part as to why we chose to establish this institution here. But I love this idea also of contemporary reimagining of, you know, this citadel of knowledge, which, as we know, Timbuktu stood for. And this sense, again, that there were not just one or two nodes, but there were multiple nodes for knowledge, for trade, for various exchanges. One of the most unfortunate things that has occurred in Nigeria's recent past is this almost deprioritization of history as a subject of importance, actually being taken out of the secondary school curriculum at one point in time. Again, just showing you this sense of disconnection between what matters when we think about economic development or progress. History is often the things you do when you're nerdy, elite, well-established, and you don't have to worry about your day-to-day. And I think if we're taking lessons just from memory, how we've built and taken care of archives and libraries, often now just left into disrepair, I think there does need to be that concentrated effort around organizing, managing, and sustaining these spaces. Otherwise, you come into Nigeria or Ghana 50 years' time from now, and there won't be anything left. So my big takeaway is that on the one hand, memory is something that you need to invest in. You need to take care of it. Otherwise, you know, everything that Timbuktu stood for kind of falls away. But I also think that connecting to the realities of your locale and making sure it retains its relevance is a big part of how that story is shaped and how much that investment really gets, disbursed.
Yeah. And I want to jump in a little bit there because I think there's something powerful about also understanding history as an asset from a recreation perspective and a story perspective, and not just a liability. Very often people want to let it go because it holds them back, when in actuality it's the center of what makes us who we are. As you've noted before in other conversations, much of how we talk about restitution, heritage, and even art itself has been shaped by European frameworks. What does it mean to recenter African perspectives, not just as a counterpoint to the West, but as the starting point altogether?
When we created, whether built our homes or developed technologies, whether 100 years ago, 1,000 years ago, we did that for our own societies as a spark for creativity, whether you're talking about the textile and fashion industry or music and Nollywood, product design. You have fantastic designers like Nifemi Bello or Shea Dallow, who are all reconnecting with not just materials, but techniques, and bringing that into spaces where we can not only empower these creatives, but actually take that forward as almost like ambassadorial products. So I think that for me is a key starting point.
I think it speaks to as well, like recognizing that as an anchor in itself, not something on the side, but something that you can actually anchor on and more than enough. Right, which is a really beautiful way to think about the work. Relately, you've called for a broader lens on how we define cultural value. What does it look like to ground cultural value in pre-colonial African worldviews rather than Eurocentric ones?
So I think cultural value can be ascribed in so many different ways. Sometimes it's based on who defines that space and whether it's your auction houses that tell you that a particular work of art is worth, $1,000 or $1 million, or it's someone who says, we're giving you this platform because we think what you're producing should be on a stage. Oftentimes that attention and the qualification of it is what has typically generated cultural value. I think if you're looking to history and find out how we constructed our own definitions of value. And one of the things that is like incredible when you think about even the way we built cities was that there was always a lot of the materials that were used were quite organic. You had mud wall and various timber structures. And there was a certain idea that things didn't need to be fixed in time. It wasn't the permanence that gave them value necessarily. It was the acts of community building and creation, that the sense that every season or so you would have to come together to rebuild and remake these spaces. And that itself was an act of coordination, an act of patronage. Those, I think, are elements that, again, give us a sense or some clues as to how do we rethink cultural value. Similarly, we think about, environmental assets. So everyone talks about climate change now. It's becoming a bigger and bigger topic. But when you translate into this space, Africans have always had a relationship with forests and rivers and cultivated offerings for spiritual deities who were seen as both custodians, but also provided instruction and wisdom as to how we lived our lives. So we've had to, in some ways, unlearn that. And now we're being asked, or at least we're granted an opportunity to relearn what these more ancestral connections could mean. And perhaps it will help us solve problems, not just for today, but for future generations. So I think it's really about understanding at its core, as you say, the anchor to your own indigenous value systems.
And this has come up in other conversations, so it's great to hear you bring it up here, this idea of sometimes it takes a sense of unlearning what we thought the answer was and completely repositioning other answers as the right answer, things that we knew already. From a health perspective, from a community perspective. And I would love for you just to chat a little bit more as this concept you just brought up, this idea of us, I wouldn't say devaluing, but rethinking about permanence as the answer, right? Maybe sometimes temperance is a temporal nature. I mean, like this, things are seasonal.
Yeah.
And that's fine, that's success. And what does it look like from a cultural perspective when we can rethink what success looks like from a time perspective? Is that something that resonates for you from a thinking perspective?
It does. And I suppose on some level, working within a museum, you're effectively, your core responsibility is to sustain, is to create a degree of permanence so that whatever you are handling can be experienced and reviewed by future generations. So there is a bit of a tension for sure with this idea, as we said, of unlearning and also thinking about the permanence versus continuity. I think one example is if you look at the guilds, Benin is known now, maybe more popularized around the brass casters, but at a time there were up to 20, 30 artisanal guilds that were creating various objects and utensils for the benefit of the kingdom and for the civilizations that were here, based here. But they have, some of them have had to have either just become a bit obsolete because of that notion of, like, if you're an elephant tusk carver, obviously the banning of poaching and just the lack of tusks to hunt for has meant that that vocation is no longer as relevant. But again, there's this question as to what do you do with that skill set? How do you translate it? Is there a way to actually bring it into new relevance? Similarly, if you go to the guilds and you look at the lost wax casting, that these are skills that have been passed on for generations, but the ideas or the inspiration behind what's being created is of a contemporary relevance. And I think there are ways to both bring, to look at permanence or look at the notion of intergenerational transfer as something that can be preserved, but how do you intersect it with new ideas? Because quite frankly, I don't think Africa wants to be locked and sort of frozen in a particular time. If you look around and you look at how technologies are being harnessed by young Africans who are finding platforms to tell their stories, there's a lot of real interest in exploring and examining new ways of being present in the world. Priorities for me is not to allow ourselves to become villagized. And I say this with a degree of, I would say, assertiveness, because having worked for, you know, over a decade, especially in a combination of international development and not-for-profit space, one of the things that I have noticed is a curation of the topics that are considered to be relevant and also the spaces where Africans are allowed to go and interact and tell their stories. I don't see any reason why we cannot have a conversation on the continent about Haitian art, or think about Mesoamerica and draw some linkages to what's been happening on the continent in this time. So I know you're starting to point in the direction of diaspora connections, but I also want you to even broaden that to more global, because fundamentally, what is subtly being or has been transferred across is this notion that you should stay in your place, and that the stories and the ideas and the knowledge that we have as Africans is not something that can be either transferred or compared to things that have happened from a broader global perspective. So that for me is a really important starting point. Beyond that, I think we have this incredible opportunity to explore the continent in a way that perhaps hasn't really been as
intentional.
Intentional, exactly. Africa has not necessarily been the easiest place to travel. You often hear about, oh, there's insecurity, or the visa application processes are really cumbersome, or finding connecting flights is stressful. But we're starting to see a shift in places like Ghana and Ivory Coast and Senegal, and certainly in Nigeria, where even governments are repositioning their markets to be more inviting. Now, that's a longer term play. But I do think that now that you have platforms like Artex, like to travel to Benin City or to travel to Dakar and actually experience art in a different way, you're also seeing a lot more collaborations. And some of this has been facilitated through artists who have perhaps were well established in parts of the US and in Europe, wanting to come back and put some roots down and create a platform that actually pulls other people up. So whether you're looking at, you know, Gas Residencies or Abraham Mahama's studio in Ghana, these become spaces for, I would say, creative collaboration, for exchange that is, I think, of relevance and important to both African and Black diaspora, as well as anyone really who's interested in learning about a different way of engaging.
And I have a question there that's not really well formed, but I would love your thoughts. So bear with me. I think that very often as well, it can be really hard. I wouldn't say really hard, but I think very often there's a lack of unified narrative around a place as well. And so with that lack of narrative, there's a lack of belonging, right? And even as we plan the season, I'm thinking about the various places that we were traveling to. Sometimes it like going from one place to another made complete sense to me. And others were like, why would you, how does that fit into that narrative? How does that fit into that story? And so I would love your thoughts on what does it look like to ground cultural value? Well, less of a question of cultural value, but what does it look like for art to play a restoring role in offering people a sense of belonging or cultural memory for those whose histories have been in some ways removed or erased or fragmented? But also it's important. We see it play out across South America. We see it play across Black Americans as well. We're all in different places, but we've used art and culture as a way to create a culture. Clearly, African countries have their own cultures, but there's a way that we can use art to kind of unite that narrative. Does that make sense? Is that something that you feel passionate about?
Yeah, I would say art and material culture, more broadly speaking, offers an opportunity to almost erase those artificial lines that were drawn up as colonial boundaries and to actually start to place histories in relation to each other. And, you know, I'll start from one simple example, which is of glass being making, an interesting research topic that we've been uncovering here at MOA, but also drawing on research from Dr. Tunde Babalola, who trained here at the University of Ibadan and is now in the UK working on a fellowship. And just by looking at this one material, you're seeing through scientific research, through archaeological excavations, how this bead has traveled, or bead making, I should say, has been exported and traded across different parts of, you know, ancient Nigerian civilizations, so places like Ife, all the way to parts of Senegal. So again, having to think about what were those connections prior to our sense of understanding of, you know, this being Nigeria and this being Senegal. So I think on the one hand, it's showing that these, whether trade or technological relations, did exist and were thriving, and that innovation was something that was considered to be valuable to these communities and has persevered over time.
Yeah.
But it also reminds me of a trip I took about 10 years ago to India, where I saw really these amazing monuments. I was in the southern part of the country. What were we building as Africans at this time? Where were our architects, our urban planners? What did they look like? What has been erased and what still remains? So part of what I think we could do is help to reconstruct these histories, give people a sense of the Africa that was, as well as project that and hopefully use it as a way to think into the future as to what a new African identity could look like.
Mm. And I also wonder, how do you use it in some ways to give Africa credit as well for so much that it's actually shaped, that it's been given credit to others? I joke that, and I've used this, tell the team this all the time, and may have even other conversations, how, you know, some 3 years or so ago, there's been an explosion of African and Caribbean restaurants in New Orleans. And it's a city that's known for fine dining. And a New York Times writer came to the city. He interviewed the chef of one of the Senegalese restaurants, Doc Carnola, so James Beard Award, and doing all the things. And he asked him, was it hard to get New Orleanians to eat African food? And the guy looked at him and was like, you do realize that New Orleans food is African food with French names, right? And even me, as someone who's from New Orleans, like, I recognize our food was for the most part Caribbean and African. But even I visited places like Savannah or Charleston and thought to myself, this feels quite familiar. I wonder, were they colonized by the French too? Like, even I didn't see that the common thread there was Africa, not France. Like, I've given France the benefit of the connection, when in many ways there's an African thread or an African story that can be told that we have to honor and have to tell.
So I'm a big foodie. One of the amazing things about food is that it's such an accessible element of culture, and it's easily transportable. It's emotive. It's something that, as you just relayed, can become part of both community practice and global exploration. When you look at Brazilian food today, a lot of it, as you said, it comes back to parts of West Africa. You're taking the same porridge or mash and you're creating something else and calling it a different name. But as you said, it falls back to this idea of this came from a continent. This is where, as you say, this is where the credit goes to.
Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. So you've taken such a bold, imaginative approach to repatriation, one that moves beyond the return of objects and towards something much deeper. If we allowed ourselves to dream bigger, it's a space to dream, I love dreaming spaces, what could be true repatriation look like, not just for institutions, but for communities, artists, and future generations?
Dream big. I hope that restitution doesn't stop as the photo op of returning objects. And I don't say that lightly, in the sense of there is a gravity towards that symbolic physical transfer, as well as the legal ownership, which I think is an important full stop to put into the history books. But if we dig that and didn't go further into revitalizing the communities that on the artisan spaces that were disrupted by colonialism itself, we would be doing ourselves a disservice. I would want to see a powerful re-energizing of artisanal spaces across West Africa. I would love to have jobs be created for young curators, for artists, for technologists who are looking for other ways to interpret what may be called art, but actually was in its own time an instrument of technology. So it's I think, really thinking about that realization that we can have, not only are these objects here on the continent or should will be here and have already started making their journey back, but that they can move us beyond this moment to becoming more creators of tomorrow.
And what's the role of the social sector in making that happen? Folks didn't see that eye roll, but yes.
Well, let me ask you this. When you think about what the role of a social sector should be, what would you see as priority?
I mean, that language there was intentional. So
yeah.
I think that we have some very, very high expectations of the social sector, but I would imagine that it's a conversation that's broader than the social sector itself. And I would even argue that the social sector's role is to not get in the way of the work, but I would love your thoughts there.
I think that sometimes the most dynamic and impressive things that happen on the continent happen because there's a young business savvy person who sees an opportunity and goes after it. I say that whilst understanding that there is an institutional role for education, and that needs to be something that we take seriously. But I would also hope that we are increasingly coming to an understanding that sometimes what we need to do is actually provide resources in a way that is accessible for a variety of skills and for people. One of the, right now, just kind of maybe taking it back to your base, which is the US, we are seeing...
Do we have to?
This is an exchange, but you're seeing how policy shifts and sometimes radically disrupts decades of building and investing in creative and social spaces. So I think to an extent, you have to be able to be flexible and to pivot and to understand that there are different points of intervention. There are movements or actions that can be done that are maybe more artist-led or people-led. There are spaces for more the concentration of and coordination of effort that may be led by businesses. And then, of course, there's policy. And when you have those three areas, hopefully working and coordinating together, then you have a space of vibrance. But it's difficult. And I, by no means is Nigeria getting that right. We have for a long time disinvested in places for culture. Nigeria is probably one of the only countries in the world that does not have a national museum in its capital. Just to give you a sense of how, in some ways, disconnected policymaking spaces can be from supporting social development.
I mean, you jump right in there thinking about funding and what it's like to fund the work. And you've spoken candidly about the challenges of funding in the creative space and how even well-meaning support often comes with strings attached, limiting what creative institutions can actually do. Staying in the dreaming space, if you could design the ideal kind of support, what would truly liberating, unrestricted funding for African creatives institutions look like?
Hope the donors are listening in.
Yes, they are.
I think more listening is needed. Oftentimes when funders come into a space, there are And I understand this because once you're running an institution at scale, you have to have guidelines, you have to have templates, you have to have criteria. But where I've seen donor support work best for MOA has been when there's another person, not just a bot, on the other side of the table. And I think this needs to be done at different scales. Simple things like just providing travel grants on the other side of, you know, a flight to get to that place and then be able to build and to create something from that. One of the things that has been really important is finding supporters who are willing not just to focus on programming, which is, you know, those are the things that are more interactive. You want to do the events, the exhibitions, the workshops, the seminars, but we need more people willing to put money down for infrastructure, for spaces that can actually support in a more sustainable way the interactions to happen on our own turf. And that is not something that a lot of institutions feel brave enough to do. And perhaps that's because of political uncertainty or just the degree of familiarity with understanding how to oversee construction projects or even understanding what the local regulatory environment is for the development of especially more specialist facilities. But that simple act, I think, would really help to transform the landscape and enable more initiatives to emerge and thrive.
And so I'd like to end on a bit of hope from a conversation perspective. And when you think about the future of arts and culture on the continent, what excites you most? And more importantly, what role do you see yourself and playing in building that and making that happen, making that a reality?
I'll start from the last point. I'm here, I would say, as a messenger, as a conduit. I'm so excited to be here and be alive at this moment. I don't think many people understand just how special it is to have this confluence of enthusiasm and attention and resources come onto the continent and start to revive these spaces. Everywhere I go, I'm seeing new pop-up spaces, I'm seeing more creative products, where you're talking about film, fashion, music, and you see the pride and the sense of I would say self-esteem and reawakening that Africa is doing things on its own terms. And for me, that is incredibly valuable. I hope that what we have, my dream is that it doesn't become a fad, because there's such a great danger in this being the restitution moment, as opposed to a new era of African creativity and enterprise, which I think is a much more powerful, game-changing essence that really will go beyond this moment. And that is why it's really important that when we think and we talk about politically weighty subjects like restitution, we go beyond just the acts of, should I say, Eurocentric return and that idea of, should I say, guilt washing.
Or even centering Europe in the
exactly.
process.
And then we ask ourselves as Africans, as Black people, as human beings, what do we want out of this moment? And how do we make it really about us?
It's a beautiful way to end the conversation. So one, first and foremost, huge applause and carrying through with a really powerful and beautiful conversation over two locations through construction as we sit here in the room with relics. It was really beautiful. And as you noted earlier in the conversation, this idea of the stream and the river, I think I mentioned one of my earlier podcasts how as a child, my grandfather would take me fishing. And at the end of the conversation or the end of the fishing session, you always make a stop and listen for the river as a reminder to, you know, remember where we're coming from and ideas that we're coming down. And cool, we're all products of that river, and you're doing it beautifully. So thank you for your time and for the conversation.
Thank you. I hope you'll come back soon.
I hear you need to come back for grand opening.
You have to. November is when it's at.
Yeah,
so.
Of course. Thanks a bunch.
Hello, Dreaming in Color family. My name is Cora Daniels. I'm a senior editorial director at BridgeBand, based in New York City. I've been part of the podcast production team since our first season. If you listen through the credits, Darren has given me the honor of dubbing me his partner in Good Trouble. And in that role, I traveled with him and Elizabeth across the continent for this season's episodes. I typically remain behind the scenes, but Darren has passed me the mic to do the outro for this episode. He has some big storytelling shoes to fill, and I thank you for your grace as I give it a shot. My father raised us to be a museum family. For fun, Some families watch sports together, others cook together. Some families kick back, listen to music, and dance a bit together. My family goes to art museums together. He felt there was no need to ever attempt to see an entire museum in one visit, because museums are a part of life, like air and water, and you will always be back. Instead, he taught us to enter a gallery room and walk through quickly, only stopping at the artwork that speaks to you. But when you find a work that grabs your eye and soul, don't rush the conversation. Spend some time with it. And only then do you look at who the artist is and the name of the work, holding it in your memory so you can always bring up the feelings that the piece originally stirred to stop you in your tracks. He was teaching us not to be influenced by the cultural value, as Ori says, that is ascribed by others, but instead develop our own definition of what is great art for ourselves. My father passed away when I was in my 20s, and the last conversation I ever had with him was the very morning when he called to ask me directions to a museum about an hour away that he and my mom were supposed to drive to the next day. Most New Yorkers take road trips to see nature. My parents would take road trips to see art, or actually to see more art, since as New Yorkers, we are spoiled to have access to museums and galleries that people travel from all over the world to see. My father was an artist, a painter. He studied at the famed Art Institute of Chicago in the 1950s, one of very few Black faces at the time allowed through its doors. However, because he ran out of money, he never graduated. I think one of his biggest frustrations in life was he could never support our family as an artist, forced to use his hands for manual labor jobs instead. He was always painting and drawing, though. The first naked body I ever saw was when I was about 6 or 7 years old, making my brother only 3 or 4, and my dad took us to a figure drawing class he was taking at night. The model came out and immediately disrobed, and every adult in the room started sketching her naked body up their easels without saying a word. My dad handed us each some colored pencils, silently insisting we start drawing too. My house now is filled with my dad's paintings. It is how my kids know their grandfather since he passed before both were born. Modernist in every way, his paintings are absent of people or landscape. Instead, they play with color and white space and geometric shape, tempting your eye to find patterns that don't exist. My dad's paintings challenge what Black American art is expected to look like, since most might see no overt conversation about race. However, mastery of color is a powerful expression of Black joy, assertion of Black taste and style, Black taking of space and demanding to be seen. I was thinking about all this when Ori was challenging us to dream big when it comes to art restitution, warning that this moment should not only be about reclaiming the past, but revitalizing artists' spaces so African creativity, Black creativity, can flourish. For Darren's conversation with Ori, we all sat in an interim pottery workroom at the Museum of West African Art, as it was still being built all around us. Every tabletop in the room was overflowing with some warm terracotta shards unearthed from the soil of the site, beautiful reminders of the great history of creativity that once thrived here. For a museum kid like me, it was a special moment, as they weren't simply artifacts, they were echoes, whispering stories still being uncovered. Standing there, I wished I could call my dad and give him directions to join me at Ori's museum. Listening to Ori, I began to understand more clearly why my dad insisted we be a museum family. These monumental homes of art are not just about preserving the past, they're about possibility. As Ori reminded us, true restitution isn't just about returning what was taken, but about revitalizing the creative spaces and futures that were interrupted. Artists reimagine our realities and help us see worlds that still need to be built. My dad knew that. Art is both memory and map. And now it's up to us to not only see it, but to carry it forward.
Once again, we put some music with the magic, collecting the theme songs from our season's guests and collaborators to create a Spotify playlist for our listeners to enjoy. Find it on Spotify, under Dreamy in Color, the continent. Thanks for listening to Dreamy in Color. A special shout out to all the folks who make the magic happen. From Africa Inside Communications, our wonderful producers, Mizute Piri and Tom Kirkwood, production coordinator, Gadik Aremba, audio-visual editor, Mamamo Giko, graphic designer Ernest Chikuni, and the amazing production crews on the ground in each country. A huge shout out to my British Band production colleagues, Cora Daniels, my ever-brilliant partner in Good Trouble, and Elizabeth Makumbi, my Joburg-based season co-host. And of course, our fabulous creative director, Ami Diane. What a squad, y'all. Be sure to rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts. Catch you next time.